The Month in Review, what Maine stories matter to you? Monday is March, and you may be thinking spring. After all, the birds are starting to arrive. But we are going to pause and look back at the past 4 weeks in Maine news. More and more people have received COVID vaccines, many at the new vaccination sites, and case numbers have fallen. But there is still confusion about how to sign up and who comes next. Senator Collins voted to impeach former President Donald Trump, and Maine Republicans have expressed their displeasure with that decision. Governor Mills laid out her plan for Maine in the State of the Budget Address, calling for perseverance and ingenuity. I'm Jennifer Rooks. What are you following closely? Is there another story in February that mattered to you? Join the conversation. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The governor presented her state budget. Maine's U.S. senators voted to impeach the former president, and Maine people continue to scramble to get vaccinated. These are some of the stories in February that we will be discussing today during our Month in Review program. With me, Susan Young, who is editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. As always, we invite you to join the conversation. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to start with Governor Janet Mills' State of the Budget Address earlier this week, Tuesday evening, delivered virtually because of the pandemic. And Ben Bragdon, I'll start with you. She called this not the State of the State Address, but the State of the Budget Address. It really did resemble a State of the State Address. Were there any surprises for you, or was there anything that you thought was particularly noteworthy about the address?
There wasn't a whole lot of surprise since we'd seen the budget, a lot of it before, and Mills had talked about it before. After 8 years of listening to Governor LePage give these addresses, I'm always surprised by the contrast with Governor Mills, who is almost poetic in her delivery of these things. But the thing that really stands out to me, I think, about this budget is it seems like it's really a recession budget. It doesn't take too many risks. That might seem appropriate coming out of this pandemic. But we know that this recession isn't like other recessions, and that it looks like we are, being set up for a pretty good recovery. And the state needs to make sure that it's ready to take advantage of that recovery, and that also that it helps all the people who were really hurt over the last few months. I mean, Maine had a lot of big problems heading into last year that Mills and her administration wanted to address. The pandemic's kind of taken a lot of focus off of those things, but they're still there, and I would be worried going forward that we're not addressing enough of those problems, and we're going to have lingering problems because of that.
Sure. And she has said on Maine Calling that she wishes, for example, she could put more money toward opioid treatment and prevention. Susan Young, one of the things she mentioned was her compromise plan on something that's referred to as tax conformity, basically the benefits from the PPP program that have gone to businesses throughout Maine, whether or not those benefits will be taxed. Republicans still aren't happy with this compromise, and it's still kind of up in the air, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be a very interesting situation if we see that as the hang-up for passing a supplemental budget, which obviously the sooner that's done, the better. Also, for businesses, they can file their taxes for 2020 with the IRS now. Obviously, we need to do it by April, as all of us do. Not knowing how the PPP funds are going to be taxed, particularly for the larger businesses, is going to become a more pressing issue as we get closer to the tax filing deadline. Her proposal would cover, I believe it's over 99% of Maine businesses, but the Chamber of Commerce and Republicans want to hold out and make sure that all businesses that have forgivable PPP loans are not taxed on those proceeds. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. It seems to us that her compromise, you know, really targets small businesses, which was the intent of the PPP loan program. Seems like an appropriate compromise to not tax the first 1 million for any business, but if a business had more than a million in PPP loans, they could be taxed on the higher amount. But they would, under her proposal, all iterations of her proposal, be able to write off expenses related to PPP loans. So, a lot of pressure to get this question answered quickly, because companies need to file their tax returns.
Greg, the legislature has not convened as an entire body yet, planning to do so in March, but committees have been meeting virtually over, I don't know if it's Zoom platforms or another virtual platform. On Tuesday evening, Senate Minority Leader Jeff Timberlake said that he's very frustrated with meeting virtually. He feels as though the legislature is more partisan than it ever has been, and in part because it's very difficult to build relationships when you're only meeting virtually. And I'm wondering what this portends for this legislative session.
Well, he's right. I think that, I don't know how you measure how partisan they are at this stage in the session, but there is something that happens when you get people together in a room and they, they talk through their differences and they're getting the sort of the body language and the nuances of the other side more clearly. They come to a better understanding. I think we've all experienced that. But, it's a pandemic, and it's still a very small minority of people have been vaccinated. And especially in the House, you have some members who are like flouting the rules and who don't think that they should have to wear masks, or they can wear masks that aren't approved. And so it's complicated. Where it all ends up, who knows? I suppose the big threat is always that you can't get 2/3 on a budget, which shuts down the government. And usually what happens is you get closer and closer to that deadline, people start to be more willing to compromise. So I don't know if remote sessions will inhibit that or not, but I think that's something to watch.
That's right. We've all covered those nights when the clock is covered up and the legislature just continues to talk about the budget. Turning back to you, Greg, the other big political story this month, obviously, the impeachment trial of former President Trump. Senator Susan Collins did vote to impeach. The Republican Party in Maine was not happy with her. Tell me about what the Republican Party did and her response.
Yeah, our annual impeachment trial, we complimented Collins for doing the right thing. Only 7 Republicans crossed the aisle to vote the President Trump had done to incite that riot at the Capitol was an impeachable offense and should have led to him being barred for running for office. But there's a real problem in Republican politics of how to deal with the post-Trump era when so many of the rank-and-file members of the party are more loyal to the president, the former president, than they are to the party and to the other office holders. And Senator Collins has kind of distinguished herself from, the Trump wing of the party. There's lots of people in Maine who wanted her to be loyal, and they wrote a letter rebuking the party leaders in 14 of the 16 counties wrote a letter that rebuked her. But if you read the letter, it's like clearly written by a room full of people who didn't agree, because there's, every other paragraph talks about what a great asset she's been to Republicans in Maine and what a great leader she is. And then the other paragraphs, we highly condemn what you have done, and, going back and forth. So there's a lot of confusion and conflict inside the party that I guess we'll see how that plays out.
Ben, do you think it has obviously probably not an impact on her reelection if she decides to run, because that's 6 years from now. But what kind of impact does it have on other Republicans in the state?
Well, I mean, like Greg said, I think it shows that we're not putting behind that era anytime soon. The AP had a story, I think, today about, you know, local Republican leaders across the country who have been continuing to talk about, you know, the stolen election and the Democrats, witch hunt of Donald Trump. That's he still has his hard hold on the party. You know, Susan Collins has become a different Republican than the majority of her party in this state, which was kind of shown, I think, by that letter. But what kind of sets her apart is she's probably the only main Republican that could have won that that race last year. So that kind of gives her a special place in the party. But it's not the same party it was 10 years ago or even 5 years ago. And I think there was a time right around January 6th where we thought, you know, reasonable people might prevail and see what they had wrought by supporting Donald Trump. But that quickly went away. And here we are right back to disagreeing on what happened that day.
Susan, anything to add to that?
Well, as Greg mentioned, the letter that the party wrote, it did feel like it was written by committee. And I think a lot of us felt that and Senator Collins' response to the letter was the end of it. But the main Republican Party has scheduled a meeting for next month to discuss further action. So, again, it'll be very interesting to see what comes of that. But I think the party may have been hoping that with the letter that this was over, but those folks who were most upset by Senator Collins' vote aren't happy and want to keep pursuing it. So some difficult decisions for party leadership to make, as they pointed out in their letter and as Senator Collins pointed out in her response. You know, she's good at raising money. She's the only Republican and Congress from New England. I mean, she brings a lot to the table, so they have to figure out how far to push in expressing their dissatisfaction with her vote in the impeachment trial.
Susan, back to you. Another big story concerning Senator Collins is yesterday's vote in the House of Representatives to pass the Equality Act, which has come up before, finally passed, which provides anti-discrimination protections on a national level for LGBTQ people. The last time this came up in Congress, Senator Collins was a co-sponsor, but this time has declined to be a co-sponsor. And so there's a lot of speculation about whether she will even vote for this. Can you tell me why? Why is she not a co-sponsor this time?
We don't know. Journalists have asked. You know, the bill is the same as the bill that she co-sponsored previously. And then now she says she wants changes to the bill, but her office hasn't said what those changes are. We're hearing she may have her own bill, but again, we don't know what's in it. So it's very curious what's changed in a little over a year. Hopefully we can all agree that all Americans should be protected from discrimination. All Americans have the same rights and should be able to live their lives free of fear of discrimination, of losing a job, of losing their housing. So it's really frustrating that people are asking, you know, what her concerns are now and not getting clarity. So to your point, it leads to speculation that this is about frustration perhaps on her part that the Human Rights Campaign did not endorse her in her re-election campaign in 2020. In the past, they have endorsed her, but this last year they endorsed Sarah Gideon. So people have to wonder if this is political payback for that group, which would just be so unfortunate that because of some ill will, shall we say, that millions of Americans, unfortunately, may not have the protections that most Americans enjoy. So hopefully it's a situation that can be worked through. The bill, of course, will face tough odds in the Senate. Expect a lot of Republican opposition, but in the Senate, Senator Collins could be a leader to put together a coalition to get the bill through so that it could become law.
Before we go to a break, I definitely need to talk about the COVID vaccinations. We have Ben Bragdon already. Some big clinics, mass vaccination clinics, have come to be opened during the last month. Something like 15% of Maine people have received at least the first dose of the vaccination. And Governor Mills is going to have a news conference this afternoon about plans going forward. Ben, what are your reflections on how things are going so far in terms of vaccinating Maine people?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, the story of the month, you know, Maine's the number of vaccines that we're delivering has doubled since the beginning of February, just about, and we're well on our way towards vaccinating, you know, most of the 70 plus. And I think Governor Mills is expected today to maybe open that up to 60, 65 year olds. It's really good news. You know, the more vaccinations that we get into the arms of the high risk categories, it might not stop the number of cases as quickly as we hope, but it will certainly cut down on the severity of the disease and the deaths. And that's very good news. The bad news is that there are still, you know, inequalities and frustrations within the system. It can be really hard to figure out when you're going to come up to get through these lines. It all has to do with, you know, scarcity and then some confusion and also the fact that, not everybody gets their health care through a hospital network, who have been handling, the mass vaccinations. And some people go to smaller primary care physicians. Some people don't have a physician and not sure where to go. Some people can't, physically get to one of these mass sites. There's a lot of people who are going to have to be vaccinated in much smaller settings that we don't have enough of. So that's really got to be the focus moving forward. I think as we get more vaccines and it opens it up to more people, the state really has to concentrate on getting it to the people who are being left out. And then later on, we can deal with have to also start thinking about hesitancy, about people who are hesitant to get the vaccine and how we're going to convince them that it's a good idea.
And Greg, your paper devoted quite a bit of coverage to what was going on at Maine Med.
Yeah, well, that was broken by Bill Nemitz in a column, it became clear that Maine Med or Maine Health was using the vaccine in ways that were not exactly complying with the state's guidelines, there was a change of guidance sometime late last year. That's in dispute about the exact date of when, but they were vaccinating employees who were not kind of people who would come into contact with patients, back office type employees, accountants, billing people, regardless of their age or their health conditions, and also vaccinated a group of anti-union consultants who were brought up to discourage Maine Med nurses from participating or voting to participate in a labor union. It's a small number of vaccines, probably. It just created a sense that people are jumping in line, which is sort of the other side of what Ben was just saying about vaccine hesitancy. There's anxiety about people who are afraid to get the vaccine. There's also anxiety that other people are preventing me from getting it. And that's why it's really important that people have confidence in the state's ability to decide who gets a shot when. So there was I think that story really struck a nerve.
We have so much to talk about, but we have to take a break. This is Maine Calling. We're talking about the month in review. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Waterville Creates, encouraging you to support arts and culture in Central Maine by making your gift today at watervillecreates.org. And Husson University, committed to leading the way through graduate study in business, counseling, and nursing to strengthen Maine's future, husson.edu.
As a kid in the 60s, Jacqueline Woodson couldn't find any books about children like her.
I was indignant, like, how dare the world not have my narrative in it?
So when she grew up, she wrote them.
I wanted to tell those stories.
Telling stories about the Black experience in America, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
And join us for the TED Radio Hour tomorrow afternoon at 1 o'clock. Maine Public is pleased to offer a paid internship this summer to a college or technical school student interested in a career in the journalism, digital news, or broadcasting fields. Candidates for the Jim Dow internship program should be attending an institution based in Maine or have an existing connection to the state. For more information, visit mainepublic.org or contact our Human Resources Department at 800-884-1717. The application deadline is March 7th.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the show, a look back at the second month of 2021. My guest, Greg Kesich, who is editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Susan Young, editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News. Share your comments or questions via email, a brief email, please, at talk@mainepublic.org. Tweet at Maine Calling. Post a comment to our Facebook page or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Calling in now, Stephen Porter, Maine editor for the Seacoast Media Group in Southern Maine. Stephen, welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me again.
I love so much hearing about what you are covering and some of the stories that may not be well known throughout the rest of the state. And one of them is the York Seawall Project. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. The York is getting pretty nervous about whether FEMA reimbursements related to a major seawall project that the town has been working on will ultimately come through, or if they do come through, if they'll come through at the full amount. So there was a major storm in 2017 and another in 2018 that caused some damage. So the town has been working on those repairs and fully expected FEMA to come through reimbursement, but it seems that progress has grown more sluggish, the progress from FEMA in terms of the approval process. And so the town now is in phase three of a five-phase project, and they're really starting to take a step back and reevaluate how to fund this project in a manner that's, you know, being good stewards of taxpayer dollars and being aware of the fact that FEMA seems to have changed its approach to these types of projects.
Next big story in your region to discuss is something that is not just a big story in York County, Maine, or in Maine, or in the New England, but throughout the country, the struggle with schools and what is appropriate, whether it needs to be virtual education, hybrid, or in class. What's going on in your part of the state?
Absolutely. So reporter Sean Sullivan spoke with four different families in our coverage area within the past week to really unpack the pros and cons of their experience with hybrid learning thus far. And one of the students that we spoke with, Brandon Schiebel, is a nine-year-old who goes to Sea Road School 4 days per week. Two of those are in his classroom, and then two of them are in the gymnasium as a sort of remote learning that's there on site. His mother told us, even though all of the school personnel are really doing great with the circumstances, the hybrid learning model itself is failing her son. And so this was one of the examples of families that are really upset and really eager to get back into the classroom as much as possible. But that school district, RSU 21, announced yesterday that they are sticking with their hybrid model through the end of the school year. I understand that there are some people who are upset about that, but obviously they are trying to balance those interests with the need for physical distancing and protecting students and staff from the virus.
And finally, how are vaccinations going in your part of Maine?
as you've been hearing from really probably throughout the states, there has been quite a bit of frustration about the rollout process. There's a mass vaccination site that's supposed to open early next week in Sanford. And so we're very anxiously awaiting this announcement this afternoon from the governor to see how that could affect the strategy and to see if we can get more vaccine supply into York County. I know that Dr. Shaw mentioned yesterday that the data the state uses to assess the rate of vaccination, the level of vaccination, it puts York County really in the middle of the road. I believe that he said they count the percentage of residents 70 and older who've had their first dose of the vaccine, at least their first dose of the vaccine. So by that metric, we're somewhere near the median. But certainly there's a lot of frustration as people are trying to iron out the wrinkles of the vaccination process and get those shots in their arms.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for calling in. That was Stephen Porter, who is main editor for Seacoast Media Group. And on the line with us now, Sarah Craighead Dedman, who is editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. And Sarah, welcome back. Tell us what your big story is this month.
Thanks, Jennifer. Well, far and away, the largest story is that Downey's Community Hospital in Machias is intending to purchase Calais Regional Hospital, and these are the only two hospitals in Washington County. And that news hit about a week ago and just kind of exploded. People were really talking about it. Calais Regional Hospital's been in Chapter 11 bankruptcy since 2019. And, you know, we live very rurally here. Maybe I know most of Maine is rural, but we're really rural. And so we really do need two hospitals to cover, you know, a county the size of two small states. So I think people were overwhelmingly in support of it. There were a few critical comments from readers, but by and large, people are pretty enthusiastic that this appears to mean that we will continue to have two hospitals. According to CEO Steve Lail from the Machias Hospital, his press release said that the intention is to run them both in their distinct locations. So that's what we know now.
Sarah, another big story throughout the state is the real estate market and how hot it is, how many people are buying homes. Is that being reflected in Washington County?
It really is. It really is. So last week we were talking about the Atlas Van Lines migration pattern report, which shows Maine being the third highest destination for inbound moving trucks. And Washington County has definitely seen our share of that. We've had last summer, I mean, for sale signs going up, coming down, going up, coming down, and just flying off the market. And right now, we have a story from one of our new younger journalists, Celia Kaminsky, this week, talking to various renovation companies and building contractors, and their business is off the charts. We have one local builder who said he's up 400% over 2019. So, you know, we're all still kind of cold and huddled inside, so I haven't really seen the difference in the community in terms of, like, people out and about in the pandemic, but I expect we'll see some real changes in our demographic next summer, this coming summer.
And finally, tell me about the National Heritage Area that may come to be in Washington County.
Yeah, this is something that's being looked at by our Sunrise County Economic Council, and they're convening a working group to explore the possibility of a National Heritage Area designation that would span both Hancock and Washington counties. And so this is a designation that would ultimately have to be voted on by Congress, but it's run by the Department of the Interior and the National Park Service. And so it's a long road. It's going to go through the government. But first, they're convening a working group of important cultural and natural stakeholders, like members of the wild blueberry industry and the salmon conservation groups, land trusts, and others. And the idea is that, you know, this could be a designation that really it celebrates the way that a region's culture and its geography and its use of the land all work together to make it unique. And ultimately, there are 55 of these nationwide so far. Ultimately, it could be something that could support greater conservation awareness as well as some economic development. So, yeah, just the beginning of a long road, but I think a worthy area for the designation.
Sarah, always terrific to hear from you. That's Sarah Craighead Dedman, editor of the Machias Valley News Observer. Thanks so much for calling in. We're going to go to Larry, who's calling in from Bangor. Hi, Larry. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm going to sound ornery. I'm really tired of people making apologies for Susan Collins. She says she's an environmentalist, yet she voted for Scott Pruitt. She says she's not opposed to having needed abortions, and yet she voted for all of McConnell's judges. During the impeachment, she didn't vote for Donnie's impeachment last time because she was afraid of her voters. This time, she saved so she can say whatever she wants and voted for Donnie's impeachment. I am just tired of all these apologies for Susan Collins.
Yeah, Larry, I think, and I'll turn to you, Greg. I think Larry speaks for many people.
As a Susan Collins apologist, I agree that there's inconsistencies in the record. I think like her decision to say she's not going to vote for Neera Tanden because she didn't like the civility of some of her tweets. This is a one of the Biden administration's nominees. Is really inconsistent with other nominees that she supported during the Trump administration. But, you know, when it comes to the specific impeachment vote, she was one of only seven Republicans to cross the line. And, I think that's worth noting. I hear what Larry's saying.
Here's an email from Janet in Pownall. I would like to ask the commentators to discuss the choice of virtually every one of Maine's politicians to oppose urgently needed regulations to protect critically endangered right whales to appease constituents in the lobster fishing industry. And she's talking about the alarming loss of 158 animals or 30% of the population during a 5-year period. She writes, I understand the importance of the lobster fishery to Maine, but it is clear that the immediate emergency measures are urgently required to protect this critically endangered species from extinction. Susan Young, I'll turn to you. And Governor Mills just wrote a letter about this week.
Again, it's another one of those very difficult situations where I think no one wants right whales to continue to die, but we still sadly need more information. This has been an issue for years, but we still don't have the best data on what is killing right whales. A lot of the recent deaths appear to be from ship strikes. Deaths are down, and as we know, there's been a decline in shipping and ship traffic, especially cruise ship traffic, because of the pandemic. So a lot of fishermen are wondering if that's why the deaths have declined, which, you know, they see obviously as a good thing. So we still need to figure out why right whales are dying. Yes, they're endangered, and their deaths are not only horrible, but it's literally against the law. But we need to know, is it fishing gear that they're entangled in? If it's fishing gear, where is it from? Is it Canadian? Is it American? Is it from Maine? The gear marking program is relatively new, so we don't know enough about what, now that the gear is marked, when entangled whales are found, either dead or alive, we'll know more about where that gear came from. It's an unfortunate situation where there are no simple answers, but we just need to know a lot more about the whale activity, their behavior, and what's killing them before we make decisions to further restrict or put further requirements for gear modifications on lobstermen. They've already done some. The most recent biological opinion from the National Marine Fisheries Service would require more, and that's what the industry is concerned about at the moment, is the potential for even further regulation.
A couple minutes ago, we heard from Larry in Bangor, who is frustrated with Senator Collins. Here's a Facebook comment from Sam supporting Senator Collins. He writes, in regards to Susan Collins voting to impeach Trump, if Senator Collins received the same volume of votes as Donald Trump in the November 2020 election, she would have lost. As a registered independent, formerly Democrat, I have voted for Senator Collins more than once. The Republican Party in Maine may be upset with Senator Collins, But I voted for her, and I feel she clearly represented me in the second impeachment vote of our previous president. And Ben Bragdon, this was part of Susan Collins' point when she wrote a letter in response to the Republican Party.
Right. We always looked at the number of voters that Trump got in this state, in his first election in which he won, and said, that was not enough for a Maine Republican to win statewide, that somebody has to add votes to that. And Susan Collins is one of the few Republicans who's proven that she can do that. And there's still a lot of independents and a lot of Democrats who felt very comfortable voting for her. I'm as annoyed and frustrated by some of her inconsistencies as anybody else. But it's clear that a good number of Mainers don't feel the same way.
All right. Well, we are going to take another quick break. We're talking about the month in review, the month of February. Is there a story that you care about you haven't heard us talking about yet? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener contributions bring us Maine Calling. With help from Harpswell Coastal Academy, a public school, grades 5 through 12, with a focus on social change and entrepreneurship, harpswellcoastalacademy.org. And BCM Environmental and Land Law of Northern New England, helping landowners, farmers, and governments problem solve, bcmenvirolaw.com.
I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Jane Clayson. This week, the U.S. marked 500,000 people dead of COVID-19. And America searched for ways to get vaccinated against the disease.
Plus, President Biden makes a trip to storm-ravaged Texas while Congress moves ahead on another COVID relief package without Republican support. That's next time on Here and Now.
And Here and Now coming up in about 20 minutes at noon. From the Top is a national radio program that shares stories and performances of outstanding classically trained musicians from ages 8 to 18. Here in Maine, From the Top is heard every Saturday afternoon at 5 on Maine Public Classical. On March 12th and 13th, From the Top will be holding virtual auditions for young musicians in Maine. If you are interested in auditioning or know a young Maine musician who might be, please visit fromthetop.org/apply. Again, that's fromthetop.org/apply for all the details.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You are listening to Maine Calling. Today on our program, The Month in Review, joining us Susan Young, who is editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor for the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich, editorial page editor for the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. You can join our conversation, if you are quick, by calling 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. I wanted to get to a couple topics that we haven't touched on yet. And Greg, I'll turn to you. Looks like voters will be voting on the CMP corridor come November. What exactly will they be voting on, and what kind of effect might it have?
Well, it's the second attempt at a referendum to stop the corridor project. The first one tried to overturn the Public Utility Commission ruling that granted a permit to the project, and that was overturned itself in the courts because it was out of the scope of what, according to the justices, what the public can do through referendum. So this kind of creates some more hurdles for projects like this, and creates some kind of retroactive zoning that goes back to the initial application of the what they call the New England Clean Energy Connect, and would require legislative approval, in some cases two-thirds approval in both houses before a transmission project like this could be approved. And I say like this, but really I think everybody knows that they've got their sights set on this particular project.
And Susan Young, speaking of CMP, bring us up to speed on the issue that we've been hearing a lot about over the last year with the interconnection charges for people with solar panels.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of came to the public's awareness when CMP told, I think it was 18 solar projects, that it was going to charge them up to 10 times as much as they had previously tentatively agreed to connect to the grid. And CMP says that they have some technical concerns about substations and just the stability of the grid to add this power into the system. And so left a lot of us wondering, you know, didn't we as ratepayers pay a lot of money to already upgrade Maine's power grid, and why is it not ready to accommodate a lot more renewable power? CMP says that, you know, the previous money was for transmission lines. These are distribution lines. And the requests for interconnection are just so voluminous that it caught them by surprise. But it leaves all of us with a lot of questions. How did the company not know what was coming with the increase in renewable energy, and also questions for state regulators? Luckily, there are several. The PUC has a couple investigations. The legislature is also looking into this to figure out what's really going on CMP, no surprise, one of the most least popular companies in Maine. Led people to believe that, you know, maybe this is just a shakedown for more money from solar projects, or an attempt to make them less viable so that solar energy won't be competing with the electricity that CMP already has on its system. But we need the investigations to figure out what's really going on and how to move forward so that these projects can get built and this cleaner power can end up on the state's and the region's electric grid.
Sure. And just to be clear and to correct myself, not talking about individuals with solar panels on their homes, but rather the solar farms that the legislature has improved a framework for them to be opening aggressively over the next few years. Ben Bragdon, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about government transparency. What's going on? Have things changed with the new administration, the newish administration?
You know, I was talking to some elected officials about this, and we had a disagreement over whether they were being perfectly transparent or not. And I said, you know, us journalists are all, you know, we're always going to disagree with elected officials over the level of transparency. They always think they're being fully transparent. And if they're not, of course, we can trust them. And, you know, reporters and editors aren't very trustful people. We want to see it all out in the open. So to answer your question, no, I mean, not much. I think some has changed, of course, with administration, but we're still seeing a number of transparency problems. The Maine State Police, it won't release their full disciplinary records, which makes it very hard for people to hold them accountable for what's going on, and to make sure that we're law enforcement is taking care of their quote unquote bad apples. And this is a big discussion going on around the country about how to move forward with policing. And if we can't judge how agencies themselves are policing their own members, then it's really hard to say how we can move forward with reform. And Susan's paper, the Bangor Daily, and the Press Herald are both suing to get those the full disciplinary records. The Press Herald is also suing the state court system, which is kind of inexplicably delaying access to civil filings, which is, again, an issue of accountability and an issue of transparency. And you know, we find these all the time at all levels of government, and we sometimes worry that we're the only people that really care. We always talk about government transparency. And I would hope that everybody from all political spectrums can agree that we should have open, transparent government. And I think maybe that's something that maybe the public should come together and put a little bit more pressure on their officials, regardless of what side they're on.
Greg, anything you want to add to that?
Oh, you know, it's just that
Maine is lucky that we have a lot of weekly newspapers who do a lot of the coverage of small towns all around the state. And we have a pretty robust environment compared to other parts of the country, but it's still hard. The news business has been disrupted, and local officials can get used to doing their work in private very quickly. And it's really important to keep these standards in place, because once they go, you know, back behind the screen, and especially now we have all kinds of new technology for people to have meetings without actually having meetings, it becomes a situation where the people's, you know, the public's business is not being done in public.
Susan?
Yeah, and as we've seen with the reporting on law enforcement that our team at the Bangor Daily News has done, when some of these records are not public, folks with long disciplinary records just get passed from department to department. And so clearly we need to hold government officials accountable, you know, whether it's the selectmen, legislature, but also some of the disciplinary records can prevent people with patterns of bad behavior from continuing that behavior and continuing to be employed. So a lot of work to do on that front to bring more accountability and transparency to systems across the board.
An email from Elizabeth: thrilled to see a child care bond in the Mills budget. Do the commentators think there will be enough support across both sides of the aisle for it? I'll turn to you, Ben.
The bonding is going to be tough. You know, you'll remember the last time we went through the bonding process, the only one that made it through was the transportation bond that we vote on just about every year. And there's a lot of really good things that were left on the table, including broadband, which is an area of, you know, bipartisan agreement, but they couldn't come up with that. And I know there's some disagreements with how to handle the child care issue. I think most lawmakers believe that it's an issue. It's too expensive, and the pay is too low for the workers, and it's not there's not enough available, particularly in rural areas. But they have different ideas for how to go after it, and some include, you know, money to pay for providers and to raise wages and to encourage more more child care, people to provide child care. But there's also a side that thinks that maybe removing a lot of the barriers towards child care providers. Obviously, it's a heavily regulated area, and some people think that removing those, we could have more small child care providers. So that's going to be the debate, and I think it's going to be tough overall to get Republicans to agree to more bonds. So it's going to be a real area of debate.
All right. Just about a minute left, Susan. I want to turn to you and talk about one story we haven't yet, which was the Sebago Lake Fishing Derby.
Yeah, as we wrote in an editorial, just very frustrating that fish got to be really quick that was stocked by the state, which now the state doesn't want in Sebago Lake because they outcompete the native fish. So they allow people to catch and keep these fish. And a lot of them were discarded during a fishing derby, when in fact the derby partners with a food pantry, and the fish could have been donated to help feed hungry Mainers. So just really frustrating that there apparently wasn't enough communication, and these fish went to waste when they could have helped people who need more to eat. So just a frustrating situation.
Well, as always, thank you to all of you for giving us an hour of your time and talking about the news of the month of February. In March, the legislature will reconvene, so we'll be plenty to talk about next month as well. Thank you, Susan Young, the editorial page editor for the Bangor Daily News, Ben Bragdon, editorial page editor of the Kennebec Journal and Morning Sentinel, and Greg Kesich, editorial page editor of the Portland Press Herald and Maine Sunday Telegram. Today's sound engineers were John Keimel and Stella Mars. Our website, mainecalling.org, will have links to programs, previous main calling programs, as well as resources mentioned on different programs. Our theme music was composed by Mike Gendro. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.